On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Microsoft and Nokia gets hitched, remote networks get switched, and we've got a super secret guest. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 57, recorded September 9th, 2013, Islands in the Data Stream. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs, and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. And by GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix, the powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate with coworkers and clients from anywhere. You can share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing, even from an iPad. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use promo code ENTERPRISE. And by TechServe. TechServe assists U.S. businesses of all sizes with their technology needs, including Apple, Avid, Adobe, and HP solutions. Visit TechServe.com/Twyatt and receive a complimentary iPad deployment assessment. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the Digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And as always, I am joined by a consummate cast of characters, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, the geek in paradise from the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory, SOAST, at the University of Hawaii. Brian, welcome back. It's always good to see your smiling face.
Good morning, Padre. It's kind of a hot, muggy day in Honolulu, but it's still paradise. And the geek in paradise still has too much junk in his lab.
Yeah, we'll be talking about that a little bit later when we go over nostalgia equipment. But before that, I want to introduce you to the other geek who's stuck in a hot and muggy place, Mr. Curtis Franklin from Enterprise Efficiency. Curtis, great to see you. How are you? How have you been?
Doing fine. I've been wrestling with large power tools and having fun as we completely remodel the swamp here. But that's moving along, and it's nice to have functional air conditioning on a day like today in Florida.
Speaking of big tools stuck in a swamp, let's talk about Microsoft and Nokia. This story broke last week just after we had our episode, so we've had to wait pretty much a whole week to talk about it. It is pretty dang big. We've got news that Microsoft has decided to buy Nokia's device business. That's not all of Nokia, just their devices, for $7.17 billion. Actually, the breakdown is that they bought the devices and services for $5 billion, and then they bought non-exclusive rights to 8,500 design patents and about 30,000 additional patents. Now, that means 32,000 Nokia employees transfer to Microsoft, 56,000 Nokia employees remain with Nokia, but Microsoft now owns the entire enchilada as far as Windows Phone is concerned. Now, let's take a look at that. Last quarter, we know that there were 8.7 million Windows phones shipped. Of course, of those 8.7 million, Nokia accounted for 81.6%, since they make some of the coolest hardware for Windows phones. And before the deal, now here's a crucial piece, Microsoft made less than $10 per device shipped, whereas after the deal, it's estimated that they're going to make north of $40 per device. So this is actually a sizable chunk. Let me get some first impressions. Let's start with you, Curtis. What do you think about this deal? I mean, the word in the Silicon Valley has been both ways. Some people are saying it's a stupid deal. Microsoft is buying the cow when they're already getting the milk for free. Others are saying this is a great deal for Microsoft, horrible for Nokia. And still others are saying, look, this is pretty much a good thing for all involved. What's your take?
Well, I don't see this as being a bad thing for Nokia in any way. I think that what it does for them is it lets the core business unload a piece of the company that was not performing well so that Nokia can really concentrate on their core switch, their big telecom side of the business, where they're still doing very well. So aside from a bruising performance for Finnish pride, I think it works really well for Nokia. For Windows, for Microsoft, I think the story is a little bit more complicated. On the device side, they now face the same basic conundrum that RIM did with BlackBerry. They should have, by all rights, a real natural end to the enterprise market, but they're going to have to make sure that they continue to bring out devices that are so attractive that consumers will want to bring them into the enterprise. It's a tricky thing to do. And, we've seen just how well BlackBerry was able to execute on that. The other part of it, though, and the one that I'm excited about, are all of those design patents. I think that's where things get really interesting, because it really gives us the opportunity to watch and see how Microsoft will continue to develop its Office Communicator, Lynx, and other unified communications portfolio alongside the mobile devices. I think that's really where things get fascinating, and that's where the true value to Microsoft comes in this whole huge deal.
All right. Chibert, I want to go over to you to talk about something that Curtis mentioned when he was talking about these rights and the rights that transferred. Microsoft did put a sizable amount, $2 billion into buying patents, but they didn't buy them outright. They don't even buy the exclusive rights to those patents. They bought a 10-year lease on non-exclusive use of those patents. So they can't really sue anybody, because they could just borrow those patents from Nokia themselves. Why exactly did they pay out $2 billion for those things?
Why is always a good question. But I get back to, Microsoft is not an equipment company. They keep saying that. But they keep buying equipment companies, so it's been confusing a lot of people. But I think it's just like the Microsoft Surface. I don't think Microsoft is as interested in making a ton of money. What their interest on the equipment, it's just like the Microsoft Mouse all over again. They want to get the market kickstarted so that they can have more interesting things that consume more copies of their base operating system, in this case, Windows Mobile. I personally also think that this is their golden opportunity to wedge in a lot of technology that's coming out of Microsoft Research that needs portable platforms, but the platform makers like Nokia have been unwilling to take the risk. Now, obviously, if Windows Mobile had taken off and they made billions and billions of money, Nokia would have said, oh, sure, Microsoft, we'll take a multi-million dollar risk, but it didn't. So Microsoft is looking for a way of, how do we kickstart new technology? How do we get beyond? How do we get the watch? How do we get the glass? How do we get this, that, the other thing? How do we get more presence in automobiles? For that, you need a mobile platform. And I think that might be what Microsoft's trying to do.
I actually really, really like that point. Curtis, I want to kick this back over to you. Microsoft has been changing their strategy to slowly move them away from being a purely hardware company to be more of a services devices company. You see it in the Xbox, you see it in the Windows Phone, you see it now in this acquisition. But as Chibert said, Microsoft has a lot of devices that they could develop, things that have been in their skunk works, in the make for a while. Does the patent portfolio allow them to do it without fear of starting up another patent war? Because, of course, they can't sue people with those patents, but they can defend themselves.
I suspect that that's a piece of it. Obviously, with some of the things that have gone on in the past 3 or 4 years, we've seen the roles of patents held in portfolio change in Silicon Valley. At one time, there was free licensing of patents from one company to another. Now we're seeing them being withheld on a more strategic basis by some companies. And Microsoft could have had some very legitimate concerns about that. I still think that Microsoft is trying to walk that tightrope, because they can't afford to jettison their partners, and yet they can't afford to wait and leave their fate in the hands of partners when it comes to hardware designs. So I think what we're going to see are more and more Microsoft, call them reference designs, out there. And to a great extent, that's what we've seen with the slates. You know, these are reference designs. They show what's possible. They, in the best scenario, earn some money for Microsoft. But what they really do is help build the market. I suspect that's what Microsoft is going to continue to do, because ultimately they want all of these things out there for, as you put it, the service market. Let's remember, a device is a one-time sale, and for most people it's a once every 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 year sale. Services revenues are ongoing, and they're what really make the eyes of the accountants light up when they see that continuous revenue stream.
Now, some of the Silicon Valley wags who are talking about this deal, again, are saying that it's a horrible deal. It's Microsoft not knowing what to do with all its cash, that it's just doing a panic buy. However, there is another side to it, and that is we know that Microsoft shuttled over $250 million to Nokia in the last quarter to keep using Windows Phone as the primary operating system for their smartphones. So in that essence, if they were looking at paying out billions and billions of dollars over the years just to keep Nokia using Windows Phone, it actually doesn't sound like that bad of a buy, especially if they can leverage that expertise into creating new devices for Microsoft, new revenue streams, new ways to get services and service contracts. My question to you, Cheebert, is there's an obvious parallel between Microsoft buying Nokia and Google buying Motorola. Do you see that as the same thing, or is this different? Because, I mean, of course, with Motorola, there were other Android handset manufacturers. With Nokia, honestly, there's really only one major company doing Windows Phone.
Well, you know, it's hard to tell. You know, I can pontificate all I want on this, but the bottom line is Nokia was in trouble. And Nokia needs to go and have a product. And a lot of people are all saying that Nokia's phones are some of the best in the industry. We've loved them ever since the soap bar phones. And the reality is if Nokia had an Android version, it will probably fly off the shelves. But Microsoft needs a way to keep that platform going. So I don't know. Maybe I'll call this the apology. You know, what else could it be? Microsoft needs something. Nokia needs something. Because it's not an out-and-out buy, Nokia is free to do other things. And we're starting to see that when we go into that press release that I stuck into the doc about Nokia, where there's a spinoff group that's going to try and develop some Nokia-like phones, but with Android. And that could be very, very interesting if you ask me. Yeah.
Let's pull away from that speculation and talk about even more speculation. And that is, Curtis, seeing this deal, seeing that the CEO of Nokia was an old Microsoft company man, does Stephen Elop now become the front runner for the CEO position at Microsoft?
I think he's probably in the pool of final candidates. I know that a lot of people have said he's now the heir apparent. I'm not sure I agree with that, because, you know, let's look at this. Number one, he was presiding over a company rather smaller than Microsoft. And also, you can't really say that he led Nokia to a record of stunning, unmitigated success. Does he have skills? Obviously. Are there people at Microsoft who are going to be glad to see him back? Absolutely. Does he necessarily become the only logical candidate to take over the desk that Steve Ballmer sits behind now? I don't think so. Again, I would put him probably on the short list, but I don't think he's a shoe-in for the job at this point.
All right. Cheebert, what about you? How do you see Elop? I mean, I'm honestly not that impressed with his tenure as CEO at Nokia, obviously for reasons that we're reading about. What do you think about him as a candidate for the top spot at Microsoft?
Well, what my opinion is actually is irrelevant because they're not going to listen to me. But Nokia is a really good technology company, but it's not sexy. It fills a nice niche. It fills a need. They seem to be doing a pretty good job of listening to customers, but you know, there's always that but, you know, but Nokia should have had Android, but Nokia should have responded quicker in the mobile market, but Nokia might have done a better job of licensing their cell technology, you know, the actual cell tower technology. And by doing that, they opened up a pretty big door for Siemens. But Nokia was one of the first companies to really get into really, really big firewalls, but they got out. So I'm not sure whether or not Elop was asleep at the wheel or whether he just had a really, really dirty crystal ball. I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Let's move away from hiring and talk about something that actually could happen at Microsoft, and that is how can they improve the Windows Phone experience now that they're bringing Nokia into the fold? Chibert, we've talked about this for quite a while, and that is that Microsoft has a decent platform in Windows Phone. You've got a Nokia, what is that, 925 in front of you. It's a decent phone. It looks good. The operating system is pretty dang good. Let's not even talk about the lack of applications. I'm talking about the integration with Microsoft's overall product schema. One of the things that really disturbed me about the Windows Phone review units that I've had through my lab is that they did not necessarily work flawlessly with other Microsoft products. It was a nightmare to get it set up with an Exchange server that was not the latest version of Exchange. And it seemed to be symptomatic of the old Microsoft, the Microsoft before the vision that they set out last October. It was a Microsoft in which divisions competed against each other. So, of course, Windows Phone didn't work flawlessly with Windows Server because Windows Server wanted a bit of licensing, which did not work well with Microsoft Office. In this new visioning of Microsoft with Nokia as their device manufacturer, what do they need to do to make that flawless transition between desktop, laptop, and mobile phone?
I think item number one, for God's sakes, put a VPN on it. There's no VPN on Windows Mobile, for God's sakes. I mean, that's bread and butter for enterprise technology. I think the number two is Windows Intune actually does more corporate level settings, auditing, and things like that for the iPhone than it does for their own Windows Mobile. So yeah, someone wasn't talking to someone else. Maybe, even though the bulk of the Microsoft employee campus is running Windows Phone, what happened to all the complaints? What happened to the Microsoft employees saying, hey, we can't eat our own dog food, fix this? So obviously someone was having a pissing match with someone else, or someone wasn't talking, or someone wasn't allowed to talk to someone. Somewhere along the line, there was a very large lack of integration that should have been there. And yes, I totally agree. It's like the bad old days of silos at Microsoft.
Yeah, Curtis, I know you've had to deal with your share of siloing at Microsoft. What are the things that you would like to see change now that Microsoft actually owns the hardware manufacturer? They've been making noise about this, being, you know, having the complete experience, having more of what let's be honest, what Apple has, the ability to say, we're going to design really good hardware, we're going to put our software into it, and we're going to create an experience that can lure people away from more established platforms.
Well, I think that if Microsoft does want to compete with Apple, and obviously they do, then they really need to look hard at what has made Apple a success to this point. And there are a couple of things. One is the design, and Microsoft has done a decent job on that, although you know you still get people debating whether the Windows 8 Metro interface is good design or bad design. Let's pretend it's good design. They're doing a decent job with their hardware, so they're working on that. The second thing is the recognition that they're part of an ecosystem now. And that means to have lots and lots of apps that work. Now, some of these apps are going to need bits of the infrastructure there. Chibert mentioned the VPN, the ability to incorporate them ever more tightly, ever more easily into the enterprise space is critical. But you've got to have apps that employees want to incorporate into the space in order to make this matter. The last thing is actually going to be the most difficult, and that is the total user experience. Apple succeeds largely because of the halo effect from the Apple stores. Talk to people, and I'll admit, my family falls into this category. The Apple retail stores have provided superb experiences, especially for those who are not tech savvy. They make it a smooth, pleasant experience that lets the people feel valued and become productive again very rapidly. Microsoft is working on this with the Microsoft Store, but they have a huge hill to climb in order to try and reach the same level where Apple is. All in all, it's a bunch of things. All of them have to work. And if any one of these is ignored, it gives Microsoft a much, much steeper hill to climb.
Cheebert, back over to you. When you look at what could be happening over the next 12 months as this sale gets finalized, as all the little details get taken care of, as employees, as resources shift back and forth between the two companies, what is something that you really want to see? What would be the first sign of things going well for you?
Personally, I think there's no excuse for things like VPN not being there. It's promised in the Windows Mobile 8.1 release, but I only got an incremental update last night, and it had some neat things and so forth, but they were more Nokia-centric. Microsoft needs to go and really kick this pig in the butt and get things moving. The Windows Mobile platform is a very solid platform. I actually killed 4 Android phones just synchronizing all 3,000 contacts. And it's not until the most recent high-powered quad, you know, like my Nexus 7 finally was the first Android device that didn't die when I synchronized my contact list. Windows Mobile, even a lower-end phone like my original Lumia 710, synchronized just fine. It's still got the best voice recognition in the business. I've tried every single one I can get my hands on, even ones that only run on full PCs, and the Windows Mobile voice recognition is still better than all of them. I really wish Microsoft would bring back a lot of the old commands. They've really stripped down a lot of nouns and verbs. But what I think Microsoft really needs to concentrate on is getting that cross-division communication going. It needs to be backwards compatible with more versions of Exchange, because not everyone's going to immediately jump to the latest and greatest. They need to have better integration with Microsoft Link, especially on the codec side. They have to get full integration. I mean, Windows Intune, the remote management of Windows Mobile should be the gold standard. It shouldn't be an iPhone. You need to get it to the point where Windows Mobile users aren't embarrassed to show their phone. There's a lot of things that can be done. There's a lot of technology that really works well, but it only kind of works because there's that last step that's missing.
There you had it. Have it, folks. Cheebert has phone shame. Now, I don't want to beat a dead horse, so we're going to move on. But I will say that this is interesting. I actually like this move. I actually think that this could lead to interesting things at Microsoft. It all depends on how they execute. Now, I know we have to say goodbye to our very good friend, Curtis. Curtis, you have to leave us now. I don't want to keep you too long. But can you tell us what's going on at Enterprise Efficiency so that the Twiat Riot can check you out?
Well, once again, September is a month when we're going to be doing a lot of radio at Enterprise Efficiency, and we'd love it if the Twiat Riot would come on over and take a listen starting Thursday, 2 o'clock Eastern. We'd love to see the voices of the Twiat Riot in our chat room as well. Big news, though, I'm getting ready to go on the road in 3 weeks. I'll be at the Gartner Symposium in Orlando, Florida. If anyone from the Twiat crew is going to be there, I'd love to meet you in human, real space. And I'll try to have some good stories. That's always a huge gathering. Lots of good information comes out of that. Looking forward to it.
Thank you, Curtis. Thank you again. And we'll see you real soon. Now, right after the jump, we're going to be talking about rapid remote deployment of networks using a couple of little gadgets from our friends over at Open Gear. But before that, I want to talk about the first sponsor of the Twiat Riot. And that's RingCentral. when Leo decided that he was going to build this studio, he wanted us to dog food in a big way. That meant that our documents were in the cloud. That meant that we did everything over web applications. That meant that we didn't want to have a bulky PBX system in the basement. So when Russell, our IT guy, went to Leo and told him that we could have all the features of a PBX system without the bulky gear and wires running everywhere, well, it was a no-brainer. We love RingCentral. There are zero startup costs. There's no PBX hardware to install or maintain. RingCentral allows us to easily customize all of our call handling the way that we need it. Our producers love getting their voicemail through their email, and RingCentral also offers the ability to send and receive faxes straight from your PC, your email, your smartphone, or your tablet. New faxes will arrive in your email inbox so you can always stay on top of your business. You can preview and print faxes, design cover sheets, and even sign faxes electronically right from your computer. You'll never have to use a bulky fax machine again. Just one more of the things that RingCentral offers to those who are serious about business. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to try RingCentral's all-inclusive pricing, as low as $20 per month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Again, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, we've got a little bit of a treat for you. It's a new data closet, and we're talking all about remote network deployment. I'm Father Robert Ballester, the Digital Jesuit, host of TWIT, This Week in Enterprise Tech on the TWIT TV network. We're here at Interop for another episode of the Data Closet. This time I'm sitting next to Peter Hunt from Open Gear. Peter, thank you very much for talking to us.
Hi, Robert.
You were on previously to tell us all about serial console servers. Now, for the folks at home who maybe didn't watch that episode, really quickly, what is a serial console server?
Serial console server is a device that allows you to have out-of-band or remote access into a data center or a place where your network equipment would be, which you would want to have access to and are not able to get to.
All right. And the underlying idea there is, you have your production network, but then you should also have an out-of-band, what we here at Interop call access ether, so that if the production network goes down, you still have a way to get into your boxes, maybe to reset them, to check the configurations, do everything you possibly can to get them running again without actually having to go down and touch them. And that's annoying if the box is down the hall or in the bowels of the building. It's downright discomforting if it's in a different part of the city or even a different part of the world. Now, your boxes are unique. I'm just going to say that. There are plenty of companies who make serial console servers. What has always impressed me about OpenGear are all the different features that you build into the box. Features that one might not automatically associate with a serial console server. Like, for example, your environmental controls. You allow people to see the temperature and the humidity, sound. And you also build in a lot of different ways to get in. Tell me a little bit about this box that I'm seeing in front of me.
Okay, so this is a smaller device that allows you to remotely access serial consoles. It has the traditional Ethernet port, which you could connect up to your out-of-band access Ethernet network to get access to your switches. But as well as that, we've added Wi-Fi, and this one has the ability to incorporate 4G or 3G connection.
So not one or two, but three different ways to get into the device should your primary network fail.
That is correct.
Now, this, of course, that's good. I mean, like, for example, when we deploy in the Javits, we want to be able to have different ways to come into a piece of gear that might be remote. Let's say registration, which is on the other side of the convention center. With this, even if our out-of-band management goes down, let's say someone cuts the cable, we can try to access it with the Wi-Fi. Let's say the Wi-Fi is down, we can now go in through the 3G, which is going to stay up throughout the city.
Yep.
Now, one of the things that I want to look at is the fact that we've got over here what I'm calling the engineer's lunchbox. This is a product from F5, a product service that they're doing. Tell me a little bit about their remote deployment service.
Okay, so this was an idea that along with the F5 engineers, we came up with at HotStage or Interop. Essentially, F5 had an issue with deploying their own network switches, firewalls, load balancers, where they'd often have to send an engineer along to do the initial configuration. This isn't very cost-effective, as you can imagine, and you only have one guy on site who might not be a specialist in everything the customer needs. So the idea of the remote deployment kit is that you would send one of these kits along, connect the F5 equipment basically to the OpenGear, and this would then provide a number of ways for a remote engineer or team to come in and configure that equipment at the customer site.
So in other words, rather than sending an engineer or engineers across, let's say, the planet, let's say we're doing a deployment somewhere in Asia, I can send the lunch pail. I can send this one kit, and in this kit, it has all the devices, all the boxes, the dongles, and the cables needed to give my engineers back at F5 or wherever I might be access to the gear that my customer has on site.
Yeah, and this is set up as a turnkey system where it will just call home.
It'll just, right. So as soon as it finds a route to the outside world, it will tell your office, hey, I'm up, I'm available, what do you want me to do?
And importantly, if that route then goes away, it will change to a different access method.
Right, right. The other cool thing about this, and this, again, this is one of those things that I'm sure your guys didn't imagine when they designed all the features, but it's something that a company is taking advantage of, is you could actually send one of these if you had a troublesome deployment in a remote location, and you could just have it sit there for days, for weeks, for months, and find out if the problem is environmental. Is the room getting too hot? Is someone accessing the room that shouldn't be accessing the room? Is it too humid? All of these are data points that you can pull down off a device that you wouldn't be able to get from an engineer who you sent just for a few hours or a few days.
Yeah, that is correct. It has the environmental monitoring. It has direct I/O connections to hook up alarms to, like you mentioned. And it's all in one box with an easy interface to use all that stuff.
Fantastic. And what are we calling this again? What's the name of this device?
This is an ACM5504, one of the variants. It does come in a variety of configurations with different antennas, different 3G, 4G modules.
And if they want to find out more, where do they find it on the OpenGear site?
www.opengear.com, and feel free to check out all of our products under the products page, as well as the large data center rack 1U type equipment that we've previously shown. We have a lot of smaller device server type equipment.
Peter, thank you very much for talking to us. Thank you again. I mean, it is one of these pieces of gear that if you don't know what it is, it seems boring, but if you're an engineer who does this for a living, it could be a lifesaver. Yeah. He's Peter Hunt. We're at Interop. I'm Father Robert. Stay tabbed.
Achievert, I know that you have experience with these remote units. I believe you're sending one 3 miles down, right?
Yeah, actually, I threw the link into the chat room, but it's Manoa, ACO, aloha.manoa.hawaii.edu. Sorry, chat room, I put in ACO. Anyway, what we're using it for is basically to extend the serial connectivity up over the undersea cable into the control center, which is underground, and give us the ability to control science packages, experiments. It's giving us environmental inside of the camera dome. So in all, hopefully, we'll be able to share a link with the chat room very soon where we will be streaming HD video from 3 miles underwater. And OpenGear is one of our sponsors.
Now, if Jason will show off my product cam, I do have an open gear box here. This is one that I've actually used in deployment. The cool thing about this is you put a SIM card in here. So from I've been using one from T-Mobile. And then you can send this to people. It's automatically configured so that when it gets plugged in, when it's connected to the equipment through these ports down here, it will actually send a signal back to my terminal saying that this unit is ready. Do I want to connect? It's a really, really cool way to do remote troubleshooting, especially since you're going in through the serial console so that you don't have to worry about any configuration mistakes that they've made. Typically, when we're doing these kinds of remote troubleshooting, what will happen is someone has borked their user interface, their GUI. And so they may not have the expertise to go into the serial console. This box lets us do it for them. Achievert, I know that you're using more capable boxes than this when we do out-of-band management. Typically, we use much bigger units than this. But do you think that the art of out-of-band management is getting lost? I'm seeing fewer and fewer enterprise-class networks create a secondary or tertiary network to get in when they have borked their configs.
You know, I wish I could say that's not true, but I'm seeing less and less and less of out-of-band management, which is really sad. I know the military designs it in. You know, I can't really say where, but I've designed it into many different projects. A lot of control systems, refineries, ships, and so forth, still have out-of-band. I don't know why Enterprise has decided that this is a good thing by putting all your eggs in one basket. For the most part, at the university, I see some out-of-band, but most of the time, for some reason or another, everybody tends to just say, well, that's right, we'll just put a VLAN on there and that'll be the control network. It's like, but you missed the point. What happens when you do bork the network? Or what happens when the next slammer hits and your in-band is completely saturated? At Interop, we have always had an out-of-band management system. And when slammer hit, because we had that out-of-band, in that case, it was only 10 meg half duplex, but because it was going over fiber, we could go for some insane distances. And we were still able to get into the serial consoles through a terminal server so we could apply the ACLs on the serial console, which wasn't locked up because we weren't in band. Right. So it needs to happen. I don't know why people keep cheaping out on it.
Jabba 678 in the chat room says what everyone's thinking. That is, it's money. I've heard more than once people tell me, well, why would we spend the money on an out-of-band management network, a second network, when we only need it in case of emergencies? And I don't understand that logic, because, yeah, it's in case of emergencies. All it takes is one really bad outage for an out-of-band management network to be worth its salt, be worth its weight in gold, because it means that you don't have to send a technician to every location, to every switch, to every box, to actually put a hand on the gear. And that was one of the very first things I learned when I started doing Interop, and that was you want to be able to fix things without actually having to walk there. It's just good practice. And it's easy to forget when all the gear is in front of you, but now stretch it out over an office, over a building, over a city, over a country, over the planet, and suddenly it makes a lot more sense. Chibert, I want to leave this with you because you are far more of an expert at out-of-band than I am. What is one thing that you would suggest for our listeners, people who maybe are looking at creating a out-of-band management network for their network or just learning how to do it and why it's different than a production network? What's a resource you would want them to look at? What's something you would want them to remember? What's a piece of gear that you think they should check out?
Actually, out-of-band management needs to be thought of a slightly different way. It's not just out-of-band management. It's also a way of recycling. It's also a way of reducing your cost of doing business. So for instance, maybe you might want to go and not upgrade your primary switches quite yet. That, you know, you want to be able to, you know, you've had problems with people, you know, viruses and crap on your network. Let's get the management off the primary network so that you might not have to upgrade quite so soon. And when everybody says out-of-band networks cost a lot of money, no, they don't. What you want to take the switches that were upgraded from last time, the ones that are sitting in a closet that you're now facing and having to pay for recycling charges, take those and use that as your secondary network so that you get more lifespan out of it. Your CFO is happier because it has a longer lifespan. You didn't spend money on it, quote unquote. You're always going to be running extra strands of fiber anyway. You're running extra pairs of this and that. Why don't you make use of it? That way those links are in use, and that also becomes an, oh my God, the primary network's gone. We'll steal it from the secondary. Right. There's a lot of ways of doing this that save you money in the long run rather than cost you money.
Yeah, and we're all about the long run. Now, coming right up after the break, we're going to be having a special guest on the show, the father or one of the fathers of IPTV, an old hat from Interop, probably one of the most brilliant people that both Brian and I have ever met. But before that, we want to thank another sponsor of the Twilight Riot, and that's Citrix, with GoToMeeting. Now, we all know that meetings are essential to the way that we work. You need to meet with people to share ideas, to share problems, and to share solutions. It's how the creative juices flow, when you can actually sit across from someone, tell them what you're thinking, and hear what they're thinking. But what happens when those meetings become hard? What happens when the people you need to meet with are in a different office, in a different building, in a different city, in a different country? Meetings can become impossible. Impossible, that is, unless you use GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix, the powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate online. With GoToMeeting, you can be away from the office and still stay connected to your coworkers and clients. Now, over the past few months, you've probably heard me extol the virtues of GoToMeeting more than a few times, and yet it never gets old because it's a product that I enjoy talking about, because I actually use it on an almost daily basis. You see, I'm not just a spokesman for GoToMeeting, I'm a customer. My work has me meeting with literally hundreds of coworkers and colleagues each month. Now, I used to jump into a plane every time I had a meeting because that was the way that we got face-to-face time. But I switched to GoToMeeting with HD Faces, and let me tell you, I haven't looked back. Not only did it cut my travel time per month in half, but it allowed me to have more interaction with the people I needed to collaborate with the most. It saved my organization money, it saved me time, and wear and tear on my sanity. I love GoToMeeting. It's so easy to use, and with HD Faces, it really is just like meeting in person. Because no matter where everyone is located, GoToMeeting allows you to share the same screen. It makes it easier for you to be on the same page. And if you turn on your webcam to see each other face-to-face, you get all those visual cues that you might miss if you were just talking over a phone, over a speaker, over a conference phone. You get to see when someone understands what you're talking about, that raised eyebrow when they're not quite on board. It's the feedback that you need to make the decisions that they want. Now, here's what I want you to do. I want you to try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. For this special offer, visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and use the promo code ENTERPRISE. Remember, use the promo code ENTERPRISE. GoToMeeting, meeting is believing. And we thank Citrix for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to the meat of the program. I promised you a super special guest, and I delivered. Now, you may not know him, but you will after this, because the internet that you're working on right now, he was one of the people who helped that all happen. Mr. Carl Auerbach. We know him as the Cave Bear. He's an old interop hand, but he's got a brand new show. He's got a brand new gig. Carl, tell us a little bit about yourself and where you work.
Well, I work at Interworking Labs, which is a small company in Scotts Valley, California. And our premise is that the internet needs a lot more testing. It's been one of my hobby horses for years. And this ties back to the out-of-band management thing just a moment ago, that the internet is just too expensive to run. When it breaks, it takes too long to repair. And it breaks far too often. So I've been building tools to do that sort of thing since the early 90s. I had an early product called Dr. Watson, the Network Detective's Assistant, I put out to be the internet butt set back in the early 90s. Since then, what we've been doing in Interworking Labs, however, is a different track, which is we test network protocols, implementations, to see how robust they are, how well they stand up to not necessarily unusual conditions, but, often unusual conditions, but conditions which they have probably not encountered in the lab. We've gone to, for example, the SIPIT, which is the test event for SIP voice over IP devices. And we pretty much broke everybody there by doing really simple things. Like one person came up to me and said, "You can't break my implementation because it's written in Python." I didn't understand the Python immunity link, but I thought, I know a way. Because SIP, for example, contains these email-like headers in it when length equals some number. So what I did is we build a box that sits in the middle. It's a man-in-the-middle device that plays with packets going back and forth for the productive purpose of tickling protocol differences. So we did a perfectly legitimate thing in SIP. We turned the number, length equals 1, 2, 3, into length equals 0, 1, 2, 3 in the packet. And I did that because I knew Python would interpret that as an octal number. And his implementation went off into the weeds and promptly crashed. So our purpose is to try to make the internet safe, to improve the internet so that when Google cars are running around on the roads, we won't have the Mars lander situation where one is speaking in inches and the other is speaking in centimeters. We want to exercise things before they cause harm to the consumer. We like to analogize ourselves to when you hop on an airliner from Boeing or Airbus, you kind of hope they took it up in cloudy, stormy weather some night to test it out rather than just taking it up on a nice, sunny, windless day. We want things to be tested under stress because we don't want things to break underneath us. And unfortunately, it is my strong belief that the internet is really brittle and that we are running on this hairiest of edges. And with our cross-linkage of the internet with things like our telephone system, our power control, energy control, what have you, that we are creating an environment which the internet, the Northeast blackout is going to be a tiny event compared to what's going to happen. And unfortunately, we're also in a world which the world's getting more and more hostile. So these events might be triggered by people who don't have our best interests at heart.
Yeah, I like that. Talking about the internet as a brittle thing. We're going to get back to that. But, I'd like to start with a few of the projects that you've worked on that really did sort of push the edge of the internet, the edge of networkings way back in the day. The first thing is, and I'm going to say this again and again, you were one of the fathers of IPTV, at least the IPTV as it was first developed. People may know it as multicasting. Do you want to explain the difference between, say, TCP/IP and RTP multicasting?
Sure. Well, RTP is, I think you said RTP, right?
Yes.
Okay. RTP is the real-time protocol. It is merely one of a zillion protocols with DNS to RTP to NTP. They're all just UDP-based protocols. There's nothing particularly weird about RTP. RTP is designed for carrying media streams, and it can be typically it's carried in UDP frames. Multicast is something entirely different. It exists at the IP level. Multicast has two flavors. There is the classical form of multicast, which is multiple speakers and multiple listeners. If you want to listen into a multicast session, you simply join using a protocol called IGMP to a group, which is just an IP address of a certain class, and the traffic magically somehow figures out where you are and gets to you. It's all the magic where the complication is. There's another form of multicast, which I think is far more appropriate for our modern internet, which is single-source multicast, which is one speaker and lots of listeners. You still do the same thing. You subscribe to a group address, and the traffic magically finds its way to you. But you don't have the problems of reconciling the fact that there may be lots and lots of traffic sources that are speaking at different speeds, different protocols, different encodings of data, and the like. Now, jumping back to RTP, RTP is designed to be kind of a carry-all for everything. And I had nothing to do with inventing it. It was invented pretty much by people like Steve Kasner at ISI down in Southern California. They, for a long time, were doing experiments. Back in the 70s, they were driving a van up and down the Bayshore Freeway near San Francisco with telephones using the Internet voice protocols back then. So I got involved in RTP, RTCP, RTCP being the control protocol that goes along with RTP, back around 1995 when I got a phone call from Judy Estrin and said, we want to start a company. And I said, that sounds like fun. So we got together and we met at her house and we sat around thinking, what should we be doing? We want to start a company. That's given. What should we do? IPv6? Yeah. Multimedia? That sounds fun. So we went after multimedia. And our goal was to create user products that could send and receive entertainment-grade audio-video streams. And this was the era of postage stamp video, when you had a couple hundred pixels by maybe 100 pixels, itty-bitty things at 8 frames a second, just awful kind of stuff. What we were doing was moving literally entertainment-grade HD. Well, it wasn't HD at the time. We were using these great big video discs, but it was still pretty good video. I can't tell you how many times I saw the movie Blade Runner or Lion King. I am totally sick of both of those movies because that was our media. The interesting thing about RTP and RTCP is they're really two-way protocols, because what RTCP does is if I'm watching a movie and my reception gets bad, my machine can send back a receiver report saying, I'm getting bad audio, I'm getting bad video. That means the senders can be adaptive. So they can change codecs, they can take corrective action. which is really nice because the internet does come and go. We've seen routing problems, congestion, things like that. As an ancillary part of what we were doing, we got involved with the whole notion of resource reservation on the internet, which is still kind of an open problem of how do I know that I'm going to be able to send the content I want and so it's timely. When you're watching video, it's we called it milk versus wine. Some data, fine. It's better. It gets older. It doesn't really go stale. But video, if you can't get a video frame to the rendering device in time, don't even bother putting it up there. You're just going to cause more chaos on the user's screen. You might as well put up just a black spot rather than a breakup. Same with voice. If you start breaking up voice, it becomes incomprehensible. There was also amazing timing problems. The one thing we really wanted to do on the internet was we wanted to repeal the speed of light. It's just too slow. A few milliseconds from here, a few milliseconds there, it really starts adding up. You cannot play with how we've over millions of years learned how to see and how to hear, and we have certain expectations. We expect to see things before we hear things because the speed of light is faster than the speed of sound. If you reverse that in your video stream so people are hearing before they're seeing, people's mind starts bending. There's also problems of sometimes you got to play catch-up in these RTP streams. When can you catch up? In voice, there's pauses. You can always pause. You can stretch vowels. You can shrink vowels. But if you're playing music, you just do not have that option. You start playing with the rhythm, and you've just totally destroyed the value of your stream. It's like watching. Drives me crazy when I see a movie over a cabled system where they've reduced the bandwidth. And it becomes like an old rotoscope. It's jerky. We don't want to reduce the quality. We don't want to damage the human factors of video. Right now, we're in a world which we're doing mostly unicast video. There's a lot of buffering involved. And we're just sort of making by. But our quality isn't really that good. If you look at a pick camera image right out of a camera, a good HD camera, and look at it through an HD TV after it's maneuvered over, even a good thing like DirecTV with HBO type media, it's still not nearly as good. We've reduced the quality. As we're moving into a world of 4K video, our demands on the network are going to get even higher. We're going to have to start getting more into resource reservations and things like that. Which brings us back to multicast. Multicast as a technology has wonderful promises. The idea of having a few senders and lots of listeners. The listeners can just join in. The packets follow an optimal distribution tree, or hopefully optimal, is a great idea. It's much better than the systems we have right now, which we have banks and banks of servers, each sending out a separate stream to each user. That's very, very wasteful because it's all redundant traffic. Multicast lets us get around that. The trouble is multicast, multi-source, is a very difficult protocol to manage in an inter-domain inter-enterprise situation, because you have situations where hot potato problems, where if I'm carrying this heavy load of traffic, I want to hand it over to my peer ISP and let them bear the cost of transporting it. And then it'll leak back into me, and I'm going to end up with a loop of the traffic flowing around. It becomes very difficult to manage. At our company, we started in 95, Precept Software. We were using a multicast protocol called DVMRP, which is called a flood and prune protocol, because it sends the packets everywhere until somebody says no, and then it prunes that branch off. Well, we had a little tiny Cisco 2500 router sitting at the end of one of our links, and we hadn't bothered configuring this thing yet. So it was sitting there screaming back upstream saying, stop sending me this multicast traffic. But it wasn't configured. Its IP addresses weren't right, so nobody could hear it. So over maybe 10, 20 minutes, we started getting every multicast group on the internet started coming down our pipe into our offices. And this was the days when a T1 was a big pipe. So our T1 went solid red. We couldn't get anything done. We had to get on the phone, call our upstreams to say, shut this off, shut us down. Well, we had to figure out the problem. It turned out that Cisco had to make a change to the router code to deal with the situation. But that was one indication of the management problems. There's other ones called PIM sparse, PIM dense mode, which use rendezvous points. And they're very, very bureaucratic. There's lots of things going on. There's a new form, as I mentioned, single-source multicast, which is much more in tune with our current way of using internet, which is like one source for a program like this one and lots of listeners. And then the distribution tree, the topology of a distribution tree only needs to get formed when a new person joins or the internet topology itself changes. It's much simpler to manage. You don't have loops coming back and forth where ISPs are hot potatoing the traffic onto others and the like. This topic, we can go into this forever. I don't know how far we want to go.
You know, Carl, actually, our chat room, which is filled with absolutely some wonderful people, we've got one of them saying...
2,500 routers are vengeful.
That's right. saying that there's a lot of people out there, network professionals, who are still confused by multicast. At Chebert, I remember you were telling me once about a story from Interop Atlanta, back when we still had Interop Atlanta, where we maxed out a couple of our two OC3s with traffic during the 9/11 events. Can you tell me a little bit about that? Because I know that the solution was multicast.
Yeah, actually, we were doing Carl and I were doing a demonstration, and so 9/11 hit. Everybody was all shocked. It was a horrible event, but they're all grabbing CNN. And we had two OC3s, which in those days was very sexy, and maxed them out, absolutely redlined. So the Interop team went around and started distributing out multicast video clients, so with, you know, bookmarks in there so people could get to CNN but not use unicast. So we went from maxing out two OC3s, so 255 megabit per second links, and we got it down, I believe, under 30 meg. And I think to this date, this is probably the most effective demonstration of just how much more efficient multicast is than unicast, especially for video.
It's a technology that really ought to come back. I hear that various edge providers are doing it for local distribution. But for big style distribution, we really ought to revisit it or make a hybrid where we're doing unicast to per ISP multicast points and multicast out at the edges. We have a long way to go in video. I was doing lots of advanced video stuff at Cisco when I left. I was working at dynamic product placement so that we could insert different products, like the old movie Repo Man, where you had the cans that were generic. I was going to replace those with cans tailored for whoever was watching. That's actually pretty easy. I then wanted to move into more face replacement so I could replace people's faces and bodies and voices, and I figured... And this Cisco didn't like hearing this part, but I figured the best customer for that was the porn industry. I also wanted to move more into interactive videos so that I'm really interested in live theater and breaking that fourth wall between the actors and the audience. Well, with a box like the Kinetics box, which is watching you, there is now a means so that if you're in the performance space, I'm an audience member watching a show. If something happens in that show and I react to it in some way, say it's a scary movie and something happens and I go, huh! In a real live theater, an actor on the stage would turn into the space and look at you. That would bring you directly into the video. It would make you, or the play, brings you into the play, makes you part of it. You become emotionally bound to it. It doesn't exist in television today, but with even simple little tweaks like pauses or focusing a person's eye into the audience space, you could completely change the emotional feel of television shows. I know that companies like Pixar and like are interested in this sort of thing because part of it is not using this kind of technology to overusing it. If you look at 1970s movies, they just invented new zoom lenses, and every movie used zoom lenses, and it becomes really annoying. We have to avoid that. We have to develop new movie kind of techniques to use these techniques carefully. But ultimately, I believe that when we start making videos and movies, we're going to have to create a soundtrack, an audio track, but also a metadata track, which is going to be tracking every object in that video so that dynamically I can replace that object very efficiently in a set-top box because I have already the metadata about its shape and color and whatever, so that I can rework the video on a per user basis based on not only who the user is, but what that user is doing at that instant and how they're expressing themselves interacting with that video they're seeing. So there's a long way we can go on this.
Carl, I actually want to give you an entire show just to talk about multicast because I'm realizing...
I'm not the expert on it. Yeah, we need Farinucci.
We could actually do that. No, but I do, before we run out of time, I do want to talk about your time at Cisco and your time with ICANN. You used to work at Cisco's chief scientist's office, and you are an at-large board member. In fact, I believe you are the last at-large board member of ICANN. You want to tell us a little bit about what ICANN is and how you got to be a board member?
Well, ICANN is the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. It's a follow-in from John Postel's IANA. It's largely thought about as the body that sits on top of the domain name system, who allocates new top-level domains. It also sits on top of the IP address system, but the IP address groups have shown themselves sufficiently responsible that they have broken off. That's Aaron, Ripe, Apnic, things like that. ICANN sits on top of literally billions and billions of dollars of assets. VeriSign pulls in almost $1 billion a year in domain name registration fees. For something that costs a penny per registration, it gets to charge over $7 each, over times $200 million each. That's a lot of money that ICANN's giving it. ICANN has, over the years, it was created to create competition in the domain name space. A lot of people say, do we need competition? And I think that's a valid question. My answer is, who am I to say no to other people's innovations? The Internet is founded on the idea of innovation at the edges. Why should I say no to somebody else's idea? I have been wrong so many times in my life that I don't want to deny somebody else the opportunity to prove me wrong and them right. So ICANN was created to create new competition in the Internet space and keep it secure and stable and so on. It has been doing this at a glacial pace. Just recently, it opened up a program to create new top-level domains. And people came out of the woodwork. They got roughly 2,000 applications. Google put in a mountain of them. Amazon put in one, a very contentious one, like .book, because people are now claiming Amazon wants to own the word book. I joined a group called Uniregistry. We put in roughly 50-some-odd applications. At $185,000 per application, and took roughly that amount of money to write each application as well. So in the next, ICANN went through this huge process of evaluating them. All of ours were approved. And we're going to start deploying them soon, we hope. So the Internet namespace should be changing radically. You should start seeing a lot of new names out in the Internet. Our first one is, of all things, probably like .tattoo. Which isn't exactly necessarily going to be the hot button for everyone, but it's the sort of thing you're going to start seeing. You'll see Amazon with books, and Google wants .search, things like that. ICANN is the organization that sits on top of that. It is an organization that is largely, I'm going to step way back here, 1645, there was a Treaty of Westphalia, which created what is the modern nation state, the thing with geographic boundaries and a government in it. We've lived with that world, that kind of world, since till about 1945 with the rise of multinationals. That's when the borders to nation states kind of faded because there were these other things that could stretch out beyond the edges of a country and, in a sense, transcend a country. With the Internet, that has really gone into spades where we have, where is Google? We saw Yahoo being sued in France for selling various items. Where's the edge of a country? And we see how tax evasion, like Google moves his money here and there and things like that happen. And even our little group, Uniregister, we're in like 7 countries. Well, the world is changing. Governments are in a panic because they don't have control of everything going on within their borders anymore because there are things that transcend their borders. Well, ICANN is one of these new kind of governments. I relate it to, and Jonathan Swift had this island called Laputa that was floating in the air above other countries. And if it wanted to exert its will, it simply landed on them and crushed them. ICANN's kind of like it. It's a government without territory. One of ICANN's problems is it has power without accountability. We have a system growing in the Internet in which democracy isn't really the rule anymore. It's the thing called stakeholderism, which is who you are, who you're associated with, not the mere fact that you are. It's one man, one vote, or one person, one vote is not the policy of Internet governance. So we've got this real accountability problem. To whom is ICANN accountable? To whom? Who can say no to it? I say, let's go back and reread Jefferson and Madison and Voltaire and people like that and relearn the lessons from this 18th century and apply that to ICANN. That's not an idea that's flying very well.
And of course, Carl, believing in the freedom of the internet, believing in the democratic system of the internet, being one of the people who actually designed a lot of the protocols, a lot of the gear that powers the internet today, you're heavily invested in that. And you actually took a stand against ICANN after you were elected as a board member.
Yeah, I was the only person ever elected in a public election to ICANN's. Well, there were five of us from five different parts of the world. Yeah, I did what a director should do. I wanted to see the financials. I had every right to do so. And it's kind of a responsible thing to do, just to make sure, are we, as a company, a nonprofit, but are we as a company expending our money wisely? And they said, no. And I said, what do you mean, no? So I ended up having to sue them to inspect the books. We went through 18 months of legal processes, got in front of the judge, and it says, what are you doing, ICANN? He has an absolute right. The California law says he has an absolute right to do this. You're being nuts. And when I finally got a chance to look at what ICANN was doing, there was nothing wrong. It was doing the same silly things any new organization did. It didn't have an employee policy, didn't have really good privacy policies, things like that. And it was spending too much on travel. But there was nothing really, they shouldn't have been so fearful. But their net result was they erased publicly elected seats. So they now have a thing called the Nominating Committee, which is really an appointing committee, which is very much an inward-looking organization that points to ICANN's board, only those who tend to already agree with what ICANN's doing, which even further removes ICANN from the concept of being accountable for its actions. And I said, these are decisions that have a lot of financial impact. I mean, ICANN received $350 million from those of us who made applications for new top-level domains. It's costing the internet users roughly $1 billion a year in excessive domain name fees paid to VeriSign, because there's been no audit of what is the cost to VeriSign to produce this product. But ICANN is simply saying it's got a cost of $7 to the public. We don't care how much it actually costs VeriSign to produce this product.
Wait, so that's an arbitrarily picked number?
I mean, it is.
It's supposed to be a nonprofit, right?
Well, that's not ICANN's. VeriSign is very much a for-profit. And they've made a pile of money out of this. I mean, you have a guaranteed revenue stream of somewhere between probably $500 million to $1 billion a year. That's nice. I would like to have that. So we've got the internet is moving towards not an internet that is well-governed. It's being an internet which is being overseen by captured regulatory bodies, ICANN being the first. There's a current brouhaha about the ITU. There's a lot of people who fear that this UN-based group, the ITU, is going to somehow take over the internet. I have no idea how. They don't do anything with the internet. They mostly deal with handing out numbers magic to cell phone systems connecting to each other. Their great internet venture was ISO-OSI, which was like a total dud, although it had lots of great ideas. They are not going to take over. The internet is really now, the future of the internet isn't even in the hands of the IETF anymore. It's much more in the hands of companies that are innovating new ideas. So where the governance of the internet is going, I don't know. But I do know that it is not looking good for the notion of democratic processes. Revisiting again that word stakeholder, I really object to the notion that your voice, the loudness of your voice in halls of internet governance is based on with your associations rather than who you are or the value of your opinion itself.
Yeah. Carl, we are just about out of time, but I did want to touch a little bit on a subject that I know you have been very active in recently, and that is the fragmentation of the internet. Now, I almost dread to bring this out because I know we could talk about this for the entire show. An entire new show. And that is IPv6 has been pushed on us a lot. And I've actually even talked about it, the inevitability of IPv6, how they're telling us, equipment manufacturers, telcos, that we need to move to IPv6 because we've just run out of address space. There are all of these warning stories that you hear that saying that we have actually run out of address space. And yet you have a different take on that. Tell us, just quickly, why is it that you don't think IPv6 is either inevitable or the great savior that many telcos are claiming it to be?
Well, I went through the OSI gossip, everything must be gossip OSI world, and watched that not happen. And I was at Sun when IPv6 first started coming into being, and this was in the early 90s. It's great to have more addresses, but addressing isn't everything in the internet. Routing is just as important. If the packets have an address and can't get there, so what do you have an address? But the thing that's happening, I see, is the end-to-end principle is dead. The new kind of address is not an IP address, whether it be IPv4 or IPv6. It's a URL. What users are caring about these days is not that IP packets go from one source interface to a destination interface, but rather that their application client reaches the application server. And if that is done through intermediaries, proxies, not NATs, proxies, application-level gateways, then does it really matter if we have a uniform, consistent IPv4 or IPv6 address space underneath it? We can have pools of addresses, each one a complete and wholly consistent 32 or 128-bit IPv4 or IPv6 address space connected by bridges. Imagine islands connected by bridges. The bridges are application-level gateways, not NATs, not carrier-grade NATs. I can't emphasize enough that NATs does not work. That way, protocols would reach the operators of each of these islands would engineer so the chosen protocols, the ones that they want to export across the bridges, would work across those bridges. So those would generally be things based on HTTP, HTTPS, various kinds of VoIP, SIP, what have you, and other protocols which the providers want to propagate. This world is very much different than the end-to-end world of the internet. Here, the only thing that goes end-to-end is the stuff that all the providers like. There will be must-haves and a lot of things maybe would like to have. Now, users don't care how it happens. They just want their apps. So we don't have a lot of user demand for end-to-end everything. There are a lot of pressures that really, or interests that really love the island and bridge mentality. We see in the news every day about how security agencies love having choke points where they can monitor traffic, where they can see what's going on, and shut it off if they want, if you're a country like shutting things off, if you'd be Egypt or China or whatever. But also we have other companies like doing data mining. The search engine companies, that's what they do. They data mine and sell advertising. They're not really search engine companies at all. I'm an intellectual property lawyer, on my other hand, and intellectual property people want to monitor for copyright violations, trademark violations, patent violations, what have you. They really like reverting to the age of Middle Ages, when you had cities with walls and only a few gates around them, so that every piece of traffic had to pass through a well-known gate, and it could be taxed and inspected and what have you. There's a lot of pressure to return to that. Countries like it, too, because they like to protect themselves. There's also a lot of groups, religious groups, for example, that would not mind carving off their own little part of the internet to protect themselves, their cultural values. And we can't object to that. That's perfectly a reasonable thing to want to do. So I see all these forces converging to that would desire an island and bridge internet. The purpose of IPv6 is to have a uniform internet, but if we have islands and bridges, we don't need IPv6. And right now, money is scarce. It costs money to convert to IPv6, because IPv6 is not an extension of IPv4. It is a replacement for IPv4. So we actually have to build an IPv6 internet to sit next to the IPv4 internet. And the IPv4 is going to be there until IPv4 goes away, and that will happen about the same time the rotary dial telephone goes away, which means never. So I'm saying that if there's no need for a global uniform address space, then who's going to continue the investment in IPv6? What's going to be pushing it when all of these driving factors are pushing towards a solution in which IPv4 can be used over and over and over again, and existing equipment and existing investments can be used over and over again? That's the short form of that argument.
Carl, thank you very much. We have to have you back. I've realized as we were starting to go through this, I'm like, wait a minute. Carl has way more to say than this. There are so many topics in the enterprise that you are versed in, so many topics in the legal side of things that you're so well versed in, that we're definitely going to have you back. But we're gonna talk to you in just a little bit to find out what you've been doing. But before that, I do want to talk about the last sponsor of the Twilight Riot, and that is TechServe. TWiET, as you know, is all about the enterprise, and we try to keep a fair and balanced view of what's going on in the enterprise, but we don't always do that when it concerns Apple. That's why I'm happy to have TechServe as part of the TWiET riot, because they get Apple. As New York's premier authorized Apple reseller and technology provider, TechServe serves creative professionals at all levels, from individual customers to Fortune 100 companies. TechServe carries a full range of Apple products, from iPhones and iPads to iMacs, MacBooks, iPods, and accessories. TechServe also has a range of partnerships with top vendors to facilitate flexible, efficient, and creative solutions for all of your business needs. TechServe assists businesses of all sizes to deploy Apple, Avid, and Adobe solutions throughout the U.S., whether you're already committed to iPads or just getting started. From sales to support, process to practice, TechServe can help. Some amazing technology solutions are being deployed on iPads right now. If you've been to the Delta terminals at LaGuardia, Toronto, or Minneapolis, you may have noticed that nearly every seat in the terminal is equipped with an iPad. Travelers can now sit anywhere in the terminal and receive real-time flight updates on their iPad, or use them to order food, play games, browse the internet, and check email while they're waiting. Over 1.5 million visitors used these iPads in Delta's terminals just this past year. The result has been a double-digit increase in food and beverage revenue and the highest customer satisfaction scores of all participating airports. OTG Management is the hospitality company behind Delta's terminals. They've turned to TechServe to provide, configure, and install the world's largest deployment of iPads, a number that just keeps growing as they add new terminals. And TechServe really was the natural place to turn. They sell, support, personalize, configure, and manage massive iPad projects, from the Delta terminals to a school with 700 chef instructors to an operation that delivered personally configured iPads to 3,000 cable technicians. TechServe is able to do full lifecycle management for all of your technology needs by providing the devices you need, getting them up and running for you and your staff, and teaching you how to effectively use them and maintaining them so that they're working efficiently. Now, TechServe also provides ongoing support so that if your enterprise has a problem, help is never further than a phone call away. If you're considering adding iPads to your business, why not ensure the project's success with the world's most efficient partner? Now, here's what I want you to do. If your business is considering integrating iOS technology at your workplace, then contact TechServe today and receive a complimentary iPad deployment assessment. Visit TechServe.com/TWiET, and TechServe will help you assess your current or future iPad needs and give you advice to make it a success. That's TechServe.com/TWiET. TechServe.com/TWiET. And we thank TechServe for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, that's it. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang podcast over multicast in the universe. Something like that. Chibert, what are you doing? What should the TWiET riot know about what's going on with the Geek in Paradise?
The Geek in Paradise is really wishing I had known we were going down the multicast rabbit hole, and I would have unarchived my PowerPoint that Carl and I did for Interop 2000. It actually had some really good demonstrations of how multicast works. Multicast is one of those topics that drive a lot of people crazy. It usually takes two or three explanations before you can wrap your head around it. But I do want to say that multicast is in wide use. It's being used for emergency public address systems where the Muzak goes out over multicast and then you send unicast to the individual devices for emergency announcements. It's also used by Norton Ghost for imaging lots of machines. It's used for lots and lots of different things. Heck, if you're using Microsoft Home Networks, that's actually IPv6. I don't think IPv6 is a bad thing. I just think it needs to grow up a little bit more. And I do agree with Carl that this whole idea of application gateways and application proxies make a heck of a lot of sense. And not the least of which is, I think that might actually increase the amount of security we have and make it a lot harder for these hackers to do damage.
Chibert, always, always, always a pleasure. And I'll see you on the interwebs. Carl, what's going on? I mean, I know you've got many interests. You are involved with all sorts of pies. You want to tell the TWiET riot a little bit about what you're doing and where they can find out more about who you are and what your projects are.
Well, my website, personal website, is at cavebear.com, C-A-V-E-B-E-A-R.com, easy to spell. I'm involved in restoring steam locomotives, but the bigger project we're working on is our History of the Internet project. My wife and I don't know anything about making video documentaries, so we decided to make a video documentary on the history of the Internet from 1965 to 1995. Actually, we're starting about more like 1840 with the Telegraph. And our idea is to try to catch first-person interviews with people who are still living. Our list of names to interview has turned out to be a death list. We put somebody's name down and they die, so we're careful about putting names down now. We figure we might have a service we could sell to people who want to get rid of someone. But we've done a couple of little ones that shows the fact that we don't yet know how to do videos, but we've started interviewing people. We've interviewed people like Dave Farber and Dan Lynch and the like. We're going to be interviewing several hundred more people. Our intent is to produce approximately 200 episodes, 5 to 7 minutes YouTube style each. We're doing the whole thing using Creative Commons licensing, so people will be able to take our edits and reuse them. And also we're taking all of the raw takes and publishing those Creative Commons, so someone in the future can use that as an archive to create their own history of the Internet. Our themes that we're focusing on are things like the government really did a good thing here, because there's been a lot of historical revisionism that's trying to write the government out of the Internet history. I did a lot of work on the classified side back in the 70s, things that haven't been revealed necessarily even yet. There was a lot of good ideas came out of there. We want to emphasize the point that there's not a single grand god of the Internet. It was really a work of many, many, many people, a lot of serendipity, a lot of good ideas that haven't been picked up on and been lost. OSI is full of great ideas that we could still data mine. That it's not done. That there's a lot of opportunity. We see a lot of people who think, oh, all the great stuff in the Internet was done by, you know, people like me with gray beards. No, the good stuff's still yet to be done. As Shakespeare said, the past is prologue. You know, what's in the future is yours. So those are kind of our themes that we're working on here. We're trying to express that. Our website for that is historyoftheinternet.org. There's hyphens between history of the, between all of those words. And we only have two episodes up so far. Working on several more. We figure when we get done, we're going to have approximately 70 to 100 terabytes of raw interviews. It's going to be quite a storage problem. What else are we working on? Well, again, I'm going to probably be involved in a big robotics experiment in the fall, which looks like it's going to be a lot of fun, playing with giant robots.
That's DARPA, right? You're doing
I'm hoping to do
DARPA.
That. We haven't got the nod yet, but I'm really hoping. And I'm involved with this Uniregistry thing, which is grand fun. I'm not working on the business side. I'm working all on the technology side. I'm working with the best people on big systems, people from ISC and other people around the world. It's just really a lot of fun to try out these new ideas. And I'm in the middle of this thing. So we're talking about, like, I really object to the Whois database. It's a privacy-busting database. I think it's just publishing too much stuff. So I'm in the inside of this animal, and I can say, let's, how can we improve the data of the protection of Whois so that people don't feel so exposed by registering domain names? We're also looking at, are there other ways of using domain names? Because there's really is a good, valid comment, like, why do we need them? And we want to allow people to explore and try new ideas. And as a trademark IP attorney, I'm really interested in how the law is interacting like this. One of my current hobby horses is auto takedowns, like on YouTube and things like that. When somebody includes a tune in a video and somebody comes in and claims it, you put a Mozart tune and somebody claims they own everything written by Mozart. Carl Malmud put up NASA videos. NASA does not claim copyright of moon landings, and somebody claimed they owned the background music. Well, these were silent movies. There was no background music at all. So there's this problem going on in the world where we have copyright trolls who are using auto takedown methods to really damage our ability to distribute media on the net.
Yeah. Carl, thank you again. Absolute pleasure. We will have you back when we have more time just to pick your brain about many things enterprise. Now, I want to thank you all. Thank you all for bearing with us, for watching, for making Twilight so much fun to do. So here's what I'd like to do for you. I want to give you an easy way to get all of our episodes onto all of your devices as easy as possible. Right now, if you go to our show page at twit.tv/Twiat, you'll find all the different ways that you can have each episode of Twiat delivered to your iPhone, to your iPad, to your Windows notebook to your zombie Zune, every possible device you might have, we give you a way to get all this goodness on your hotness. Also, as long as you're there, why not visit our Twiat YouTube page at youtube.com/Twiat. There you'll be able to find not only all of our episodes, but also all of the individual segments. The data center, stuff my IT guy says, all those little things that we do to learn you a little bit about what's going on in the enterprise. Also, follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. That's important because not only will you find out what's going on the next episode of Twiat, but you'll also be able to give me feedback about what you want to see in future episodes. And really, I listen. It's how we know what we want to cover next. You suggest it. We find the guests. Next thing you know, it's up on the show. Now, finally, did you know that we do this show live? That's right. Every Monday at Pacific time, at noon Pacific time, we get here into the studio and we put on what we think is the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. So go to live.twit.tv and you'll be able to see how the sausage is made. That's right. You get to see the pre-show and the post-show and the bloopers, all the things that don't go into the downloadable episode. And as long as you're here, why not join us in the chat room? Twit probably has one of the best chat rooms still left in existence, and it's filled with brilliant engineers, with funny, funny people, and yes, some incredibly entertaining trolls. Oh, and by the way, a really good set of mods. So join us and experience some of the temporary community that is the Twit experiment. Finally, I want to thank everyone here in the Brick House who makes this show possible, to Karsten, my super producer, and to Jason Howell, who's my technical director. Now, Jason, I do hear that you have a show of your own, don't you? I'd like to feel that it's something that talks about all things Android. What might it be called?
All things Android and all things KitKat as of late. All about Android, twit.tv/AAA. We record every Tuesday, and we talk about Android things. So there you go.
Yes, absolutely. And we just got bombed by Theater Monkey, which is fantastic. Well, I'm Father Robert Ballasair, and I just want to remind you, want to know what's going on in the enterprise? Just keep Twiat.